Hi, my name is Mike, and I'm one of the ministers here at the church. I'd like to start by thanking you for listening to this sermon online. Before we get started, I'd just like to say that we truly hope that this audio recording will encourage you in your walk with God. But we also hope that it would just be supplemental to your relationship with Jesus, and that it would in no way replace the church that you should be plugged into or the spiritual leaders God has put in your life to shepherd you. So please, enjoy the next 30 minutes or so of this message. I pray it will challenge and uplift you wherever you are in your spiritual journey. God bless.
Good morning. Good to be with you this morning. If you're a guest here, we're glad you're here. If you're watching online, I'm so glad that we live in an age where that's a possibility and you're able to still connect when you're not able to be here in person. A woman woke up one night, in the middle of the night, rolled over and noticed her husband wasn't there. And so she got up, kind of wandered around the house, and she found him standing in the room where their baby was. And he's standing over the crib, and he's looking down, and he's just having this moment of reflection. And so the wife kind of stands quietly in the doorway and just kind of soaks it all in. Watch him, and as she's looking, she sees he's there, getting a little misty-eyed maybe. So she just watches and kind of savors the moment. Then eventually she kind of quietly steps in and says, "Honey, penny for your thoughts." And he said, "You know, sometimes I really just can't believe that I got this crib for $50. Sometimes it's easy for us to miss the important things that are right in front of our eyes because we're too distracted and focused on other stuff. Or sometimes things become so commonplace and routine that we forget how important and significant they really are. Our text for today, I think, might be one of those things for some of us. You see, in the first half of Mark chapter 14, which is where we're going to be this morning. Have a Bible, please turn there and follow along. But in the first half of this chapter, Mark is trying to set the stage for us of what's coming next. And so this morning, we kind of want to follow that pattern and set the stage for what's coming next for us as well. And so this may not be your typical three-point sermon with a big conclusion at the end like you might expect. But I just want us to take this time this morning to kind of sit in this moment with Mark and his readers and Jesus and the disciples. You see, this is the turning point of the Passion Week. And it's a story we are so familiar with, I think sometimes we're at risk of simply overlooking it. Here's the part we're headed towards, kind of in the middle of Mark 14. Starting in verse 12. On the first day of the festival of unleavened bread, when it was customary to sacrifice the Passover lamb, Jesus' disciples asked him, "Where do you want us to go to make preparations for you to eat the Passover?" So he sent two of his disciples, telling them, "Go into the city, and a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him. Say to the owner of the house that he enters, 'The teacher asks, where is my guest room that I may eat the Passover with my disciples?' He will show you a large room upstairs, furnished and ready. Make preparations for us there." Disciples left and went into the city and found things just as Jesus had told them. So they prepared the Passover. When evening came, Jesus arrived with the 12. And while they were reclining at the table eating, he said, "I tell you, one of you will betray me, one who is eating with me." They were saddened. And one by one they said to him, "Surely you don't mean me." "It is one of the 12," he replied, "one who dips bread into the bowl with me. Son of Man will go just as it's written about him, but woe to that man who betrays the Son of Man. It would be better for him if he had not been born." And while they were eating, Jesus took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and gave it to his disciples, saying, "Take it, this is my body." Then he took the cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, and they all drank from it. "This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many. He said to them, "Truly I tell you, I will not drink again from the fruit of the vine until the day when I drink it new in the kingdom of heaven," or kingdom of God. When they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. If you were here last week, you hopefully remember that we noted that there's a lot more going on in the Passion Week than we typically think. A lot more going on between the time Jesus enters Jerusalem and Resurrection Sunday. Even between the triumphal entry and the Last Supper, there's a lot of stuff going on that we often just kind of skim or skip over. We talked last week about Jesus and his disciples and how they were in the temple courts, and Jesus was teaching and kind of verbally duking it out with the Pharisees and the Herodians and the Sadducees and the scribes and the teachers of the law. And it seems like every night, like he would be in Jerusalem during the day, and every night he'd kind of go out to the cottage community of Bethany, just a couple miles from the city. And that makes sense because probably every spare room in Jerusalem had been booked for months and months for the Passover feast. It's likely good for them to get out of town every night to let things kind of cool off with the religious leaders and even just to get some breathing room from the crowds that were constantly seeking Jesus out and surrounding him. And this is where we pick up the story at the start of Mark 14. He says, "Now the Passover and the festival of unleavened bread were only 2 days away, and the chief priests and teachers of the law were scheming to arrest Jesus secretly and kill him. But not during the festival, they said, or the people might riot." It's a couple days before the Passover, and Jesus is having supper at the house of Simon the leper, presumably Simon the former leper. But they're at his house, and John's account, we find out this meal is actually in Jesus' honor, probably because Simon is now a former leper, thanks to Jesus. And we also find out that Lazarus, who we know is there, and also his sister Martha, is the one catering the event. Now, my guess is that Mary was there also to help her sister serve the food. But, as we know that Mary has a tendency to do, she kind of got caught up in the moment. Forgot she was supposed to be serving the food, and so in the middle of the meal, Mary stops and she anoints Jesus' head with some very expensive perfume. Mark's account just identifies her as a woman, but John, who likes to include the more personal details, says, no, it was Mary, and she's the one who poured this perfume on Jesus' head. And this was not some cheap bottle of Axe body spray. It says both in Mark and in John that it was expensive perfume worth 1 year's wages. According to the internet, the average wage in Saskatchewan last year was $57,000. That's some expensive perfume. And she poured it out on Jesus' head, and maybe with that number you can understand people's reaction, because everyone was aghast at the gratuitous waste of this valuable resource. It could have been sold off and the profits used for so many good things. And once again, John's the one who steps in and names names. He says, actually, it was Judas specifically who objected to this and said that we could have used this money to feed the poor. And then in what I think is probably John's reflection long after the fact, he said, actually, Judas didn't care about the poor. He's the guy who kept the books, and he likes skimming a little off the top, and so he saw this as an opportunity. Now, the reason this little tidbit is important is because after Jesus defends Mary in what she's done and says, actually, she's preparing my body for burial, and so this is a beautiful thing that she's done. Mark tells us this. Then Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went to the chief priests to betray Jesus to them. They were delighted to hear this and promised to give him money. So he watched for an opportunity to hand Jesus over. And this is important if we want to understand what happens next. We need to know that this happens. And we need to know that Jesus knew that this happened. The next day, the disciples come to Jesus and they ask where they should make preparations for the Passover meal. Jesus sends two of them into town and says, you need to look for a guy carrying a jar of water. Luke tells us specifically that it was actually John and Peter that Jesus gave this mission to. And as was typical in most places in the world at that time, and still a lot of places today, carrying water like this was just not something a man would do. Each May, we participate in the global 6K Walk for Water. And if you notice, when they send us their promotional materials, they almost always say that it's usually the women and children who have to make that daily trek to go find some water and bring it back to their home. I remember several years ago now, I was in India on a mission trip, and I saw these people walking down the street, and they had these big metal cans on their head, and they were walking around and carrying them with no hands. They were just like balancing them on their head. And I casually remarked, hey, I'd like to try that sometime, just to test my own dexterity. And everyone laughed at me. Like I had just said the most ridiculous thing, and they said, yeah, guys don't do that. All that to say that in the first century, this guy carrying a jar of water was quite possibly the only guy in Israel carrying a water pot, and almost certainly the only guy in Jerusalem carrying a water pot. So there was zero chance that Peter and John were going to accidentally follow the wrong guy home. Now there's some debate on how we should understand this scenario. Did Jesus just kind of mystically somehow know that this man would be at the well drawing water, and somehow just know that if Peter and John followed him back to the house and told the guy, hey, we need a room for 13 for the Passover tonight, he would say, oh, I just happen to have one prepared and ready for you. Take mine. No, I guess that's possible. But as I read this story feels a lot like the story we came across back in chapter 11, where Jesus sends a pair of his disciples to go borrow a donkey colt. And he says, when you get there, just take the colt, and if anyone asks, just say, oh, the teacher needs it. He will bring it back later. In this story, when Peter and John find the owner of the house, they say something very similar. This is what Jesus says. Tell them, the teacher asks, where's my guest room that I may eat the Passover with my disciples? Did you notice exactly the question Jesus gave them? He says, not do you have a guest room? He says, hey, where's my guest room that I may eat the Passover? See, I think nothing here is random or accidental. I think Jesus is driving the bus and he has his route exactly mapped out ahead of him. I think Jesus probably arranged in advance to borrow the man's donkey colt, and I think he made arrangements ahead of time for this room to be prepared and ready for him. See, Jerusalem was a powder keg, and so they couldn't just hold their Passover gathering anywhere. And so maybe a prearranged place at the home of a loyal follower would be a good place to have it, rather than somewhere publicly known. Perhaps the secret location was also because Jesus knew that Judas was looking for an opportunity to hand him over to the chief priests in a moment that wasn't public or visible. Fun side note here. The general consensus is the house where the Last Supper was held belonged to Mark's parents. We kind of get this from something Mark's going to say a little later in chapter 14. And this would kind of all connect the dots and kind of fit, because if you remember in Acts chapter 12, Peter has been put into prison, and then an angel comes in the middle of the night and busts him out of jail. And when Peter gets out of jail and realizes what has happened, he goes to the house of Mark's mother because all the Christians were gathering there to pray for him. So Mark's house becomes this kind of gathering place for Christians later on. And so that, along with some other things, makes us think that maybe it was also the place where the upper room was. Which means that it's also possible that the man Peter and John saw carrying the water jug might have been Mark himself. Which means he's relating this story firsthand. Now, that doesn't really change the story at all, but it is interesting to consider. So, here we are. We've finally arrived at the upper room. But we're not quite to the really core part of our text yet. See, Mark skips over what happens before the meal. But it kind of plays into the context of what's going on. You see, Jesus and the disciples arrive with their feet dusty and dirty. And everyone's looking around for someone to wash their feet. If they had just come home to their own house, they would have done it themselves. But as they were a guest in someone's house and this was a special meal, they were all expecting someone else to be there to do it for them. Maybe the homeowners couldn't afford a servant to do that kind of stuff. Maybe it was Mark's job and he was just too busy or just simply forgot to do it. Maybe Jesus already had a plan of what he was going to do, and so he told the homeowners, yeah, don't worry about having someone to do that. I have an idea that I'd like to play out. Whatever the reason, no one does it until Jesus steps up and washes 13 pairs of stinky, dirty, calloused feet. Now, if you read this story, most of you probably remember the part where Peter blurts out that Jesus can have nothing to do with washing his feet. Until Jesus says, well, if I don't wash your feet, you have no part of me. Which when Peter says, okay, let's do this right, head to toe, let's wash everything. Peter was never a halfway kind of guy. Now, we don't know what order the disciples were lined up in when this happened. Don't know who was first or who was last. Was Peter at the beginning or the end or somewhere in the middle? And for the most part, that doesn't matter much. But I do wonder where Judas was in that batting order. We don't really know, but I have a hunch that maybe he was sometime after Peter. Perhaps immediately after Peter. Because Jesus responds to Peter's request for a full body wash by saying this. Those who have had a bath need only to wash their feet. Their whole body is clean. And you are clean, though not every one of you. For he knew who was going to betray him. And that is why he said, not everyone was clean. Imagine most of the disciples just wrote that off. If Peter wasn't the very last one in line, then obviously there were still others who weren't clean yet. But imagine being Judas as Jesus dried off Peter's feet and then slid the wash basin in front of you. Imagine being Jesus, knowing all that Judas had done the night before, all he was about to do later tonight, and taking his foot and gently lowering it into the water. Most of us would have been more likely to throw the water at Judas rather than wash his foot in it, but not Jesus. And now we finally arrived at the Last Supper. As Jesus and his disciples settle in to participate in the Passover meal. Now, obviously, we're familiar with the part at the end with the bread and the cup because we reenact that part every Sunday. But before we get to that, we need to take note of what happens first. While they were reclining at the table eating, he said, truly I tell you, one of you will betray me. One who is eating with me. They were all saddened. And one by one, they said to him, surely you don't mean me. It is one of the 12, he replied. One who dips the bread into the bowl with me. Passover was this intimate, personal family meal. It was something you celebrated with the people you were closest to. And in the middle of this most sacred moment, Jesus drops a bombshell. He talked about being betrayed before, but the disciples had likely assumed that it would be one of the Pharisees who did it, or maybe a mole that had come in and pretended to be a true follower, but really wasn't. Sure, they never considered the possibility that it might have been one of them. Even though they didn't know who the betrayer would be, they knew very well what it meant. Jesus had been talking about this all the way since chapter 8. They knew that betrayal was not just about having feelings wounded or even being driven out of town like it happened in Nazareth. They knew, because Jesus had talked about this regularly, they knew that betrayal was followed by beating and suffering and death. So when Jesus says, one of the people sitting at this table will betray me, they must have all been in complete shock. They began saying, surely you don't mean me. And the translation there is a little bit misleading because what they're saying isn't a question. It is a statement. Well, I know you can't possibly mean me. Every one of them said, there's no chance that I would ever do that, Jesus. Peter said it. John said it. Matthew said it. Nathaniel said it. Thomas said it. And Judas said it. Judas said it, and no one suspected he was lying. More than they believed any of the other people around the table could possibly do such a thing. We know from John's account a little while after this, Jesus actually leaves and goes out. And everyone thought, oh, he's just going out to get more supplies. Or ironically, to go give money to the poor. No one knew where he was really going or what he was really about to do. But Judas knew. And Jesus knew. In fact, as Judas leaves, Jesus says, what you are about to do, do quickly. If it had been me, I would have called Judas out a long time ago. At the very least, on the way out the door, I would have said, hey guys, you know where he's going? Maybe back when he was at the Simon the leper's house, and Jesus knew what was really in his heart. The first hint that something was off, I would have at least kept Judas at arm's length from then on. If I had ever had even an inkling of how this was all going to end up, I would have never let Judas be one of the 12. But Jesus never did any of those things. He doesn't even do it the next time Judas pops up in the story. And that can be hard for us to understand. That's because we're focused on the crib, not the baby. We began the series noting how in Mark 8 there is this distinct turning point in the story, both metaphorically and geographically. After Peter's confession, recognizing Jesus' true identity as the Christ, the Son of God, Jesus turns his feet towards Jerusalem and his eyes toward the cross. Everything from that point on, especially in this last week in Jerusalem, is purposeful and planned. The donkey's colt, the shouts of Hosanna, the cleansing of the temple, the teaching throughout the week, the anointing at the Bethany, the washing of feet, the Passover with the disciples, even the preparation of the upper room. And it may all seem random and chaotic to the casual observers. I'm sure it felt like that to the disciples at time. But for Jesus, this has all been one straight, very intentionally followed line from Caesarea Philippi in Mark 8 to the upper room in Mark 14. This is not happenstance or the actions of others that have brought Jesus to this moment. This is his own purposeful planning, which is why Jesus' last big lesson for his followers was to take the Passover meal, the most well-known and cherished an important celebration of the greatest, most dramatic, most meaningful example of God stepping in and rescuing his people from their inescapable bondage to slavery and death and redeeming them and bringing them into a land of rich blessing. Jesus takes all that and transposes it onto what he is about to do on the cross. While they were eating, Jesus took bread and he gave thanks and he broke it. And he gave it to them, saying, take it, this is my body. And he took the cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them. And they all drank from it. This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many. This is Jesus explaining to his disciples in a way that they will not fully understand or appreciate until the next time he's in the upper room with them after his resurrection. He's explaining what he's about to accomplish for them and for us. Jesus' eyes have been fixed on the cross, where his body will soon be broken and his blood will soon be shed to purchase redemption and forgiveness for all of us. It has all been leading to this moment. And now the stage is set for the most impactful event in human history. For the disciples, the next 3 days are going to be the most intense of their life. We get to take about 3 or 4 weeks to walk through all that at a bit of a slower pace. But we're going to do that as we head towards Resurrection Sunday in just a few weeks. There's a lot more stuff that we could have talked about this morning, especially about Passover and all the symbolism in that and how Jesus reinterprets a lot of that. For the last several years, we've hosted a Passover Seder. A Seder is a Christian version of the Passover. And in that, we kind of walk through, here is what the Passover was like, but here is how we understand this all differently in light of Jesus and what he's done. The first year, we did it with the teens. Last year, we did it with some adults. We're going to do it again this year with some other adults. And if you're wondering why you haven't got your invitation to that, it's because I've found that the ideal size is somewhere between 12 and 14, which I think is interesting because Jesus did it with 13. So that seems to track a little bit for me. But if you haven't got your invitation to that, we are trying to get to everyone to have a chance to do that. And I hope when the invitation comes your way, if you have an opportunity, you will join us for that, because I think there are some insightful things that can help us and understand the Last Supper and even help us understand what we do each week when we take communion. So hopefully you will get around to that eventually when we get through the list, and hopefully that will be meaningful to you as well. Let Robert come and lead us in the close of our worship time.